Anyway, as I mentioned before, this is the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for more than 43 years. Every Sunday night at 8 o'clock, we get together and we sit down and hopefully we educate each other, inform each other, and amuse each other. So I hope that will be the game plan for tonight. Let me drop for a second, and I will come back almost immediately with the usual links. Okay, as per usual, we have an email address that you can either send me email to ask a question, suggest a topic for discussion, offer any technical puzzles that we're always looking for, or to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him about a space or NASA-related story. His email address, you can email him directly at spacenetreport@gmail.com. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. We also put up a link page of all kinds of interesting articles that I've read through that week. I cut and paste the links and give them their own page, and you can look them up at your leisure. The page is open 24/7, so any old time you can check it out. You can get there by typing in roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room available. So if you're interested, you can visit. Sometimes it's busy, sometimes it's quiet, but, you know, you can check it out by typing in on your browser chat.ac2gs.com. That will bring you to the chat room. We offer an audio stream of this technical net and the Glen Oaks repeater in general. Any old time you have Internet provider service, you can type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And that'll bring you to the audio stream of the TechNet and the rest of the repeater the rest of the week. Also, I like to remind people of MyKC2NJI's great archive site called amateurradio.tv. It has over 1 million visitors. It has archives of this Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom. Any old time, it's always available. So let me drop, and I'll be right back with tonight's plans. Okay. We will ask for questions of a technical nature tonight. I would prefer at least the first few questions to be amateur radio related, but as anyone who's listened before knows, we will discuss any aspect of science and technology as best we can, if anyone's interested in asking a question. That'll take us to approximately 10:15, where Paul WS2N will give us the SpaceNet report. I will return approximately at 11 o'clock p.m. to put a bow on it and wish you all well and sign out for the technical net. So that's the idea, as long as my radio, my computer, and the laws of physics allow, and the repeater. So with that all in mind, if anyone has any either questions, topics for discussion, comments, what have you, please hit that push to talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
K2GJE, I have a question on some old technology.
This is Alan, N2KW.
Okay, Ed and Alan recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down?
Some helpful things from ham radio related.
Okay, Wes recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down for tonight? Okay, first up is Ed. What's your question or your comment for tonight, Ed?
Good evening. Years ago, during the Second World War, there was no GPS. The government had a system developed called LORAN. I believe that stood for Long Range Aid to Navigation. And they used to have stations along the East Coast, and when the equipment became war surplus, the boaters would buy it up and use it. It looked, the receiver looked very much like an oscilloscope and had like a 5-inch CRT. Does any one of our engineers know how that system worked? Over.
Okay, well, I don't know that much about that. So if there's anyone out there who knows about this technology, please share.
WA2VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I know one or two things. First of all, Loran went out at 100 kilohertz. There were synchronized chains of stations that would transmit pulses at 100 kilohertz. And what they did is to map out lines of constant difference of arrival time. And those lines, when you put them on a map, show out to be hyperbola. So by mapping out, finding the difference in time of arrival of a signal from different chains, you could locate yourself.
Oh, okay. Very good, John. Is that sufficient, Ed?
I guess that's part of the story. I did speak to a gentleman years ago who is no longer alive. He told me when the military was hopping from island to island in the Pacific, it was his job to set up these radio stations that transmitted this 100 kilohertz signal. I believe there was you would see a line on the oscilloscope with some like dots, how they interpreted, and I believe you had to have a map, and you had to have a navigator. That it wasn't an easy thing to navigate by. I was just interested in, and I know all the LAN stations have been shut down. They no longer exist, and the boaters that did buy this equipment on Radio Row, you had to have, electricity on your boat. You had to have a sizable boat. I was just interested, over.
Oh, okay, Ed. Well, I'm glad that you voiced your interest. I've read about LORAN in passing. No one really authored the, at least what I was reading, the technological aspect of how it ran. So it always was in the back of my head. Like most things, the old ways were a little bit of a kludge. The modern method with GPSs are much, much, much better refined, but go and figure out how to put up all those satellites or the accurate time basis back in the time that LORAN was thought up. So, interesting subject, interesting technology, another thing that I'm going to have to Google sometime this week and read more about. So I thank you, Ed, for bringing up the subject.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I worked with a fella. He used to go fishing on a regular basis on a small boat, and he would think nothing of going out by himself, and he had this LORAN receiver in that boat. But, you know, this was, the 70s, and by that time there was a gadget that I believe it did all the work for you, you know, converting the signals. So it was relatively easy for him to look at the screen to figure out, you know, where he was. And, he said he loved it, you know. He depended on that, and he was very happy with it. And, again, yeah, I remember him talking about the 100 kilohertz signal. But, you know, he didn't need a navigator, you know. He's, you know, in the 70s anyway. You know, he'd go out by himself, and no problem. Back to you, Roy. WS2N.
VDH with one more comment.
Yes, John. Also, John, if you happen to know the accuracy that Loran had, I'm sure it improved over time and the technology allowed, but if you have any kind of ballpark figure for what kind of accuracy Loran offered users.
That information I'm not sure of. I know the reason why they had an oscilloscope one there is that you had to get the time difference of arrival of pulses from different stations in the chain, and that's what you were able to map out your location on a chart by looking at those lines of constant time difference, difference of arrival on a map.
Thank you, KW.
Yes, Alan?
Regarding the accuracy, I remember when fishing boats used to use Loran before there was GPS. And when they wanted a piece, they'd be within 50 and 150 feet. And they'd have to drag the anchor around to find the piece. And then double anchor like that. Between 50 and 150 feet over.
Okay, thank you, Alan. That's pretty good. I mean, it's not quite as good as GPS, but it's a lot better than I would have guessed. So that's good to know.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Another thing my friend talked about was this was the time when GPS was starting to come out, and originally it was out for the military. And they had two different settings for the GPS. And one was for the military, and that was very accurate. And then there was one for everybody else. And he did not like that. I mean, he found the Loran at that time, you know, you could do both. It was more accurate. So he was staying with the Loran at the time. Kind of think of the year. I'm going to say probably... that'd be 1979, 1980. Back to you.
Okay, that's interesting to know. Yeah, I mean, there, you know, GPS was kind of a military semi-secret. What they did at one point was encrypt the most significant data to make it very, very accurate because they didn't want other countries to use it for warfare against ourselves and allies. And so they encrypted it. I kind of was under the impression that they decrypted it and left it decrypted for sundry reasons, although I could be wrong. I think it became so important just for the infrastructure of the United States and Europe and other countries that they felt that knocking it off would be a big detriment to any product that utilized it. So I was familiar with the military-grade GPS versus the civilian grade once upon a time.
Okay, one time I asked him, why is it so important? I mean, what difference, if you're out in the water? He says, no, certain spots you would want to get to, that's the best fishing, you know. And the closer you are to that designated spot, the better off you are. I said, wow. Understood. Back to you.
Yeah, I could see where some fishermen have their secret favorite spot where you know, just a perfect storm of fish and other aspects, and they want to go to the exact same place. So, you know, I could understand, you know, for Loran. And, of course, GPS revolutionized a lot of aspects of maps and direction finding and other such things that hopefully improve over and over again. And I remember the very early times these GPS-driven devices got things terribly wrong, and these guidance systems would suggest that people basically drove into a bay And occasionally people did drive into the water for some strange reason. Goes to show how authority affects some people sometimes. AC2GS, anyone else with any comments about Loran or any aspect of this? What I always find fascinating when I think in terms of the GPS is that without Albert Einstein's theory of relativity, you wouldn't be able to make any sense of the relativistic changes of the timestamps of the signals in order to give the proper accuracy. So if we didn't know about relativity, at the very least, we would have to set up some kind of absurd model that effectively reproduced Lorentz transforms in order to get meaningful data from our GPS satellites.
M2KW?
Yes, Alan.
I'm really confused about what you just said. The Loran is a different time of arrival for radio signals. It's the speed of light. You know, it's a fairly standard calculation. But relativity is the relationship of matter and energy. C happens to be in the formula, but how does relativity relate to Loran?
Okay, I think you either confused or you misunderstood what I was saying. I did not say Loran. I said Lorentz transformation. Lorentz transformation is a mathematical formula to deal with objects that approach the speed of light. And another aspect of relativity, it's not all E equals mc squared. And it isn't even emc squared in general. Emc squared is for an object that is traveling at no relative velocity. Anything that travels at a relative velocity, E equals mc squared plus pc squared squared. But there's a bigger Einstein relativity equation that has to do with time dilation. So in this way, what I'm talking about, that you need to do Lorentz transform operations is because of the relativistic speeds of the time signals. That time actually goes at a different rate above a certain elevation. As you get closer to a gravitational field, your time slows down. As you go farther away from that center of gravity, that gravitational force, time would seem to be faster than the people on the Earth. So a satellite system that's above the Earth, its time sequence is not the same as an atomic clock on the surface of the Earth.
Okay, well, it went over my head. I better stick with 1090 plus 2T over.
Okay, feel free. It's just the underlying concept of Einstein's general relativity is that space and time are not absolute things, that time passes at different rates depending upon the curvature of space-time from any mass. So you can't say that a foot is always a foot. You got to kind of say a foot is that length at rest. Because if you take that foot ruler and you speed it up to very close to the speed of light, it shrinks down. So space and time are all relative. There are no absolutes. The absolutes were in Newtonian physics, had a universal reference point that doesn't really exist according to relativity.
Sure.
Yes, he was. He was a very clever fellow. He came up with relativity. He kind of came up to a degree with quantum mechanics. He came up with entanglement of particles, which he hated because they didn't make any sense to him. because they suggest something called non-locality. We tend to like to think that things act upon other things by being next to them. But a non-locality would suggest that you could affect something very, very far away from you without any kind of field being used to get there and back. So, indeed, he was a very deep thinker. Any other comments before we move on to something completely different?
W2BC?
Yes, Rich.
I was late to the party because I was listening on Middle Island and heard nothing, and so switched over to Selden. So for some reason, Middle Island isn't linked anymore, or wasn't 10 minutes ago. I just want to put my name on the list. I have both a ham radio-related topic and one non-ham radio topic.
Okay, very good, Rich. I have you on the list. I don't know what's going on in Middle Island. Maybe it's some kind of after effect of doing the linking for the Aries get-together that they had last Sunday. I don't know. If it lose around, feel free to explain.
One last comment?
Sure, please.
Point to H. Yeah, internet is down. We're going there tomorrow to see what's going on. There's no internet accessibility into Middle Island.
Okay, thank you, Lou. That certainly makes sense. You know, these things are ripe for failure. You know, the more complicated things get, the more likely something's going to go wrong, as those poor schnooks who went down in the Titan discovered, unfortunately. But thankfully, all these problems are far less dangerous for us. So thanks, Lou, for the explanation, and thanks for everything that you and the guys who keep these repeaters going do for us, and don't get the thanks that you all deserve.
What interested me on the Loran subject was that it was kept secret during the war. The Japanese never picked up on it. The B-29s, and we had almost, a thousand of them in the Pacific Theater, carried Loran. And although I don't know what good it did, the Norden bomb sight was useless when there was cloud over a target. Just history facts that I'm interested in, over.
Ah, good. Yeah, I like history. I like history a lot. I like facts a lot. It's kind of interesting the types of things that we were able to snooker the enemies into not figuring out very soon. You know, it might have been somewhat obvious that there's something weird going on in the United Kingdom during World War II, that they were seemingly able to detect nighttime raids. They did it because they had invented radar, of course. But rather than either leave the question blank, I think they publicized this bizarre idea that they had given all their pilots carrots to improve their night vision. Okay, no comments on that. So, again, anyone else who wants to say something before we move on to the next question?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I missed that, but did you say carrots for night vision? Is that what you said?
Yes, yes, vitamin A. They promoted the idea that vitamin A was good for your eyes, so they fed their pilots carrots, And so they had better night vision, and it wasn't anything about a secret weapon that they had that could tell this, you know, planes in the distance even nighttime, like radar.
If we could go back to the archives, the somewhere in there, we need to set some kind of a Google search. There's a whole thing about that topic that Dick used to talk about, and his opinion was that was a rumor that they said that the United States said that they were misinformation. They would have the pilots eat carrots because that, you know, that's going to help their vision. But the reason they were doing it is because we were developing radar and we didn't want them to know. But he had a whole long thing on that topic. Back to you, Roy.
And you, KW.
Yes, Alan.
Yeah, I beg to differ. Vitamin A does affect your vision. Although I'm sure that England used it for propaganda purposes to conceal that they were developing radar. But let me tell you what a vitamin A deficiency looks like when you see it. It's called night blindness. And those are simply words until you actually experience it. So you're driving down a dark country road, which is perfectly illuminated by your headlights. You have no problem seeing where you're going until the car comes at you. And then all you see is the headlight from that car. You can't see the road, the shoulder, parked cars, a child crossing, or anything else. All you see is that one bright light until the car... You better pull over.
Yes, Alan, I agree with you, and I understand that vitamin A is good for vision. I was simply stating that the information released, you know, what was a kernel of truth, basically hiding a big lie, that it wasn't the carrots that was doing it, because these young men probably did not have a vitamin A deficiency. It was the development of radar technology that the Allies were trying their best to rationalize away, so that no one would kind of get suspicious of how the pilots seemed to find the targets in the middle of the night. So that's all I'm saying.
Understood. Agreed.
Okay. You know, I mean, it's a lot of times the military kind of uses things like that. You know, I sometimes think that they promote UFOs because of that kind of weird way of getting around experimental aircraft that they'd rather people not focus on. So they'd rather have people write headlines that we have a whole team of crash-landed aliens who are scribbling away the advanced technology that we're using for ourselves, because people are a little weird and they have this idea that ancestors had brilliant ideas and aliens have brilliant ideas, but present-day human beings can't have any brilliant ideas. And so, you know, what can I tell you? It's an interesting technique that some agencies do to distract people from thinking of obvious things otherwise. Anyway, I guess we kick this one. So on to the next. Alan, you have a question or a comment tonight?
Yeah,
the British bombed at night. The Americans bombed daytime.
In the old days, we used TNC to connect to the packet cluster or to BBS systems. Cantronics made a KPC-2 and a KPC-4. And these are some of the things that I got from AA-2A's salvage. I'm wondering if they're in use anymore, or if they're obsolete these days. Cantronics, KPC2, KPC4.
It's my understanding that although packet technology is not a popular thing anymore, there's so many other ways of transferring data on radio waves that it kind of fell down. And also the company, I think, that patented a lot of the technology, locked up a lot of stuff in legal binds and such. So it kind of, people got tired. You know, when computers first came out and Internet first came out and packets on the Internet, people took to configuring packets, transfers using RF and these terminal emulator type of devices that then took the packets through the radio, modulated them and transferred them. So I think you'll find a small niche group of people still using that equipment, but unfortunately it's not going to be popular ever again. You know, it's sort of like ATV. There are guys out there that love ATV and do ATV, but not a lot of them.
Is there a BBS that is accessible from the metro area?
Not to my knowledge, though. Those things have gone away many, many years ago. If anyone knows a bulletin board server that operates on radio packets, please let us know. I would be amazed to hear that there's one still thriving.
I guess that answers the question. Thank you. Answer KW out.
You're welcome, Alan. You know, I mean, it was an interesting technology. It's mimicked a little bit by, I think it's called WinNet, which is an email service that some people set up radios to just transfer, email messages. And they'll have the antenna picking up the email, and then they'll send it through the Internet the rest of the way. So I think that's still a real thing, and emergency ARIES and such tries to get some use out of that. But I don't know any consistent use of packet technology these days.
All right, thank you much. And once again, answer KW out.
Okay, Alan. Well, thank you for participating tonight. Next on our list is Wesley. What's your comments or questions or topics for discussion tonight, Wesley?
Two things. Last week we spoke about some antenna that was extremely wide, and you said something. It was fun.
Wesley, something is knocking your audio completely out. Instead of listening to you, I'm just listening to a low-level hum, which I guess is another carrier someplace. Wesley, do you hear me, Wesley?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Something was transmitting over your signal. So all that I heard was you kind of whispering about, I don't know, 20 decibels below and the slight hum. So someone out there is playing hijinks. Might I suggest that maybe we bring Rich up for the time being and hope that whoever is playing hijinks will finish a couple more glasses of vodka and fall asleep and let us do our thing?
Give me a few minutes. You can talk about something else. I'll be there.
Okay. Rich, let's move you up there. I'm sure Wes wouldn't mind, especially because there's someone out there who has something else on his mind. Rich, what's your question for tonight?
Okay, first of all, I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but Roy, you're 30 to 40% noise, at least coming through the Selden repeater. So just thought I'd let you know that. My question is, let's say you have an air variable capacitor rated from 70 to 200 picofarads. How can I build a circuit around that would either lower that range or increase that range? That's the question.
And UKW.
Yes, Alan.
Increasing the range is easy. Bridge it with another capacitor. Capacitors in parallel add. Lowering the range is a little bit more difficult. Capacitors in series, they don't add. I don't know if they support. Maybe you could answer that.
Yes, if you put them in series, they decrease. So the way that capacitors work in series is like the way resistors work in parallel.
Okay. What is the application? I have a feeling this is a mag loop question.
Yes, it is a mag loop question. Rich has a mag loop. He had one variable capacitor. He got a bigger variable capacitor, and now I guess he wants to know how he can adjust things. Let me just check to see that I have the repeater. Okay, I seem to have the repeater, and unfortunately to Rich, I'm running at 100%, which is about 50 watts, that my ICOM 7100 is capable of, and I really don't want to throw in my amplifier because that's how I blew out my last antenna. So the problem you're going to have is, yes, you can do it. You can increase the capacitance by putting an additional capacitor in parallel. You can decrease your variable capacitor by putting a capacitor in series. But again, you're going to have the problem with the insertion loss. Every time you make a new connection, you have another place for an insertion loss, and magnetic loops do not do well with more than the minimum amount of insertion sites.
Well, if I keep the leads really short, like a half inch from capacitor to capacitor, do you think that would be a significant insertion loss?
M2KW.
Yes, Alan.
I've done an awful lot of work with mag loops. I really understand the design. It's almost like the antenna's taller to me. And the efficiency drops like a stone as you add capacitance. They're really only efficient at the highest frequency they cover, where the capacitance is minimized. I mean, you could probably resonate a hula hoop 60 meters if you had enough capacitance, but that doesn't mean anybody's going to hear you. And you can have an awfully high voltage at that capacitor. So, you can't do all things. What are you trying to accomplish with the antenna? And I'll tell you if you can.
Well, the large capacitor that I have, tunes the mag loop from 20 through 40. But it doesn't go into the CW portion of the 40-meter band. So, in this case, I would like to increase the capacitance so it nudges me into the CW portion of 40. The other thing I'm thinking of doing is widening the mag loop by 2 feet. I can't manipulate the height of it. I can't add to the height of the mag loop. In this case, mine is a square, not a circle, because it won't fit through my front door if I make it any taller. So all I can do is widen it, and I'm thinking about widening it 2 feet. That will give me now a non-equal rectangle, but it will increase it by 2 feet. What are your thoughts, Alan?
I think that if you widen the antenna by 2 feet, you will lower the frequency that you coverage that you cover, but you may lose the highest frequency that you cover. I guess this is homebrew because it's square, because all the commercial ones I see are round or hexagons or, yeah, some of them use coax cable, which is a big mistake. Shield is inductive. Can use celiac, but you can't use a coax. Yeah, if you make the antenna wider, it'll cover a lower frequency. But once again, don't expect miracles on 40. Look at my QRZ page. You'll see an efficient monoband design for 20 over.
Well, this mag loop of mine has been working wonders on HF. With a smaller capacitor, I'm able to go from 10 through 30, get great signal reports, work stations around the world with it. With the bigger capacitor, I can only go from 20 to 40, but I need to get into that CW portion of 40. So it is multi-band. It's been working like dynamite. I just now want to either be able to get into 40 meter CW, or, I mean, surprise me and maybe get to 80 meters. I doubt that jump would happen just by adding 2 feet. But that's my aim, at least to get into the CW portion of 40 meters.
Okay, well, forget about 80. How much power do you run?
I run 100 watts.
Okay, well, you're going to have a hard time finding a capacitor that will handle the voltage. I've got a fixed vacuum variable that's 50 puffs. Get something like that and put it in parallel with your variable capacitor, and you'll definitely cover 40. But you're introducing resistance, and resistance lowers the efficiency of the antenna. So, although you're only running 100 watts, there used to be an antenna called the Phantom Bat. And it was 100 feet long. It would look like a dipole. It was 100 feet long, and it had a bat in the center where you connect the coax. It was epoxy sealed. Eventually, somebody cut it open. There was nothing. And there was nothing in the middle but a resistor. So the antenna was resonant on all bands. And it was a 100-foot dipole, and, enough power got out so you could communicate. It works, but it traded from favor fast when people realized they were putting their power into heat.
Surprisingly, I have not caused any arcing or any damage to the capacitors, or, well, that's about it on this antenna, to the capacitors at 100 watts. I don't know if I'm putting out exactly 100 watts. I know on CW I'm getting close, but on sideband I can't tell because I have mismatched meters on my antenna tuner, which I don't use with the mag loop, but I just use the meter in it and in the radio, and no problems at all with 70 watts, let's say, 70 to 100 watts, no problems with arcing or burning or anything else that people, you know, warn you about with just a regular air variable capacitor. Let me turn it back to Ned. Go ahead.
Let me give you one thing to try. Take 2.5 feet of RG8 or RG213 or LMR400 or whatever you got, about 2.5 feet, and connect that across the capacitor, because the cable itself has capacitance. And then with your capacitor at maximum, cut the piece that you just added until you're in the CW band on 40. And now you've got a shunt capacitor that's made out of coax cable. It should handle 100 watts. And if it doesn't, it's certainly not going to damage your vacuum variable, over.
Not a bad idea. I could try that before lengthening the square. But as I said, this antenna has performed beyond my wildest dreams, and I just wish it would go into 40 meter CW. Anyway, that was the question. Thanks, Alan, for your advice. I'll give that a try with the coax. I'll give that a try actually tomorrow with the coax, and I'll report back. Roy, back to you.
Be sure to look at my QRZ page.
Will do.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Alan. Good luck as always, Rich. Yeah, introducing a coax in a way that it's operating as a shunt capacitor will add some degree of capacitance, and you can adjust the length of the coax to see how much you need. It's most likely going to introduce more resistance, and that's not a good thing, so you might be able to tune, but you might not really be able to be heard once you're tuned. But you give it a try. CW is much more forgiving than phone, so you might get something useful. And Alan was talking about a strange dipole with a resistor in it. I forget if it's Arrow or Diamond. They have a multi-band HF antenna. And if you check out the ballon that feeds that antenna, it basically, a good percentage of the RF gets burnt up into heat, so that when you check for reflected power, it's very low, so you get the wrong impression that this is a highly matched antenna when it's just a very lossy antenna. But, you know, sometimes just 1 or 2% efficiency is enough to make that contact, so be it. Anyway, good luck, Rich.
The State Department bought plenty of a design called T2FD from Parker and Williamson, and that was nothing but a 600 ohm resistor and a 4-to-1 balance.
Well, again, you know, if you don't need a lot of efficiency, then it's sufficient to work. It won't reflect back power. It won't cause your transmitter to go into fold-over safety mode. And, you know, if you just need a small percentage of your transmitter power to get into RF, then that's sufficient. I'm sure that company, again, I'm not quite sure if it's Diamond or Arrow, sell a lot of those. And every so often I'll read these reports where guys do thermal studies of the ballon and show that it's kind of heating up. You could probably make some hamburgers or some hot dogs by putting it right down on that ballon when you're using it at full legal power.
But don't forget, if you're burning up half your power and heat, by definition, that's 3 dB.
Well, that's true, Alan. The only trouble is a lot of these things are not 50% efficient. Like I mentioned repeatedly in the last 6 months or so, hamsticks. They make hamsticks that are designed for 80 meters and 160 meters. And, you know, if you need an antenna that's going to supposedly work on your transmitter in the car and you don't have that much height, you use what you got to use, although those are about 1% efficient at best. So 50% efficient is great, but, you know, you start to get into the place where you're 1% efficient, where, you know, it's a little problematic.
1% efficient is fine, too. I spoke to a guy in Bulgaria who was running 37 milliwatts. I've spoken to England where I was running 26 milliwatts. So if you're putting into the antenna, you're losing 99 and getting a watt out that's still out.
True. And if you're in a situation where all it takes is that, then great. But a lot of times, the ones that got away, no one knows because they got away because they couldn't hear you because propagation conditions weren't quite as good. So, you know, there is a point in some propagation conditions where you have to have more power efficiency than less than 1%. There are other cases that you certainly can do miracles with less than 1%, but those are not 100% of all communications that the average amateur radio operator takes on during his hobby.
Well, you know, the old adage was you can't hear them, you can't work them if you can't hear them. And then they came along with FT8.
Okay, yeah, FT8 is a fascinating technology. It uses computer algorithms, error correction, redundancy, ultra-slow symbol rate, and all kinds of fun stuff to be able to send signals below your noise floor. But, you know, there are times that if you can hear them, sometimes you can't get them to hear you. If your antenna is great but you're putting out a microwatt, then, you know, I mean, I'm sure you've had cases where you've heard the other station but they don't seem to respond to you. So although there is such a thing as antenna reciprocity, I think some people draw too many conclusions that receive and send is equivalent. As far as the signal is, it's equivalent, but there's a variable of how much output that person transmitting to you versus how much output you transmitting to them. So, you know, if they're using full legal force and a Yagi, and you're using a dipole and 10 watts, there's a lot of chance of them not quite hearing you, but you hearing them.
Got time for a story?
Certainly, Alan.
I'm on 20-meter sideband, and the Indians had an expedition going to Andaman. It was a YL operator named Bharati. I think it was VU7WCY. And somebody asked her on 20 sideband, they said, when will you be on 75? And she says, we will be on 75 this afternoon. Gave the time, it was about 4 p.m. local time, broad daylight. We will be transmitting 3895. No, I didn't get that wrong. I'll say it again. We will be transmitting 3895 because that's the VU band. And we will be listening 3795. Let me let it drop. So anybody who wasn't on 20 meters, who didn't have a score, who didn't have a friend, had no clue where the DX was. They'd come across the pile up on 3795 and assume it's below, and it was really 100 kc above. My 80-meter antenna was a full-wave loop, 10 feet off the roof in Manhattan. It was very quiet, and the only place where I was loud was down south. The pig farmers thought I was very loud. Never went DX with it. But I set up with the split with my ICOM, 100 watts. I set up with the split, and sure enough, she comes up and calls CQ, and I can hear every inflection, but she's not moving the S meter at all. And the pileup on 3795 was fierce. And all the big guns were there, and one at a time, they all busted their roof. She says, the W2XYZ, you're 5 and 5. He says, QSL, the 3 and 3. She says, negative, negative, you're 5 and 5. He says, got it that time, 4 and 4. Negative, negative. I heard every single report. And I waited my turn because she wasn't moving the S meter until she went to CQ. And I called her and she couldn't hear me. I never worked for U7WCY, but I heard every contact over.
Okay, that's a good story, Alan. It kind of demonstrates people's misunderstandings antenna reciprocity. You know, these things happen, and that's why, you know, sometimes there's a bunch of people I talk to, and they say, I never use a linear amplifier. I can't get it with 100 watts. It isn't worth getting, type of thing. And, you know, okay, different strokes for different folks. I have a linear. I use it when I need it. I don't use it when I don't think I need it. Sometimes it's very advantageous to have a few extra watts to throw up to the antenna. It depends on propagation conditions. There are cases where I tell the story that I have a friend who lives a mile away from me, and one day on 10 meters, just as a joke, we both switched our transmitter to our dummy loads and had a very nice conversation. So, you know, sometimes you barely need an antenna to communicate. Okie doke, I guess we dealt with that. And Rich, once again, I wish you good luck, and I'm sure you'll come back and you'll tell us how the additional strip of coaxial cable influenced your resonance and you can't unfortunately directly figure out what the efficiency is, but the ultimate utility of it you'll be able to. So I wish you well. Wes, you want to kind of get back on the radio and see how things go this time?
How am I coming out now?
Sound fine right now.
I'm not surprised. Okay. I have a few things. I sent you the long list, but I'm not going to go. It's rather like something that is convenient. But I'm going to go back to the discussion that we had last week. So, there was Glenn and 6GN, and with his third article, he had many of them in ARRL. It was about surface wave transmission line theory application for use by ham radio operators from 160 meters to 3 centimeters band, and he presented the antenna. And I memorize, as you say, if something sounds too good, it's probably not. And I look at it and I don't have a reason to not believe in it. It's very well documented with the antenna part, with the pictures, and with the test that they have made.